Romans 1 was presented by Ron Julian on August 10, 2006, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Just a word of the same warning I gave last time. This is not going to be an extended exegetical discussion of every issue in each verse in the section, but I'm pulling out of it what I think are some of the interesting points that relate to our topic this week. I see it as there's kind of two sections to deal with in our passage. The first section, Paul relates faith with what he calls the righteousness of God, and this is his foundational comment on the gospel, and it's really, I think, the opening salvo for his whole letter. It introduces many themes that he wants to talk about in the letter. The second section relates the wrath of God with mankind's knowledge of God, and that, I think, begins the first sustained argument of the letter. So let's start with Paul's key opening statement, where he says, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith. I would like to point out here that I think we have a real help in understanding the somewhat obscure phrase, the righteousness of God, in the fact that Paul goes on to say, as it is written, and then he quotes that passage from Habakkuk. Because I think the passage from Habakkuk is easier to understand than Paul's phrase about the righteousness of God. And so let's look at that. We talked about that the last time I was talking. Let me just remind you of the three key elements in that statement in Habakkuk. It talks about the righteous one, that is, the one who is right with God, the one with whom God is pleased. It says that that one will live and not perish. And it says that it is by virtue of the fact that he believes what God has promised, that he has faith, that he is indeed this righteous one who will live. I think it's important to be clear. It's easy for us to hear this phrase, the righteous man will live by faith, and think that what he's saying is something like the good man will live his life in such a way that he exercises faith. It is by faith that he will conduct himself in his daily business. That's a true biblical idea, but that's not what Paul is saying here, and that's not what Habakkuk was saying. He's saying the man who is right with God will live and not perish, and the reason that God is pleased with him and will give him life is because he has faith. He will live and not die because he is a person of faith. Now, Paul is quoting Habakkuk as a defense and clarification of his statement, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the one who is right with God will live and not perish by virtue of his faith. So I think this helps us to see that the thing that Paul has on his mind when he's talking about the righteousness of God is not God is righteous, but rather the state of being in the right with God, the justification, the rightness with God that comes from God. I'm sure you all talked about that quite a bit in your discussions, but that's where I would come down on that question. We're talking about a rightness with God that God is prepared to offer. And Habakkuk makes it clear that faith is the condition that makes the man right with God and makes it so that he is going to live. So from faith to faith in this context, after all, Paul is saying that the Habakkuk passage is basically clarifying and saying what he just said. So the from faith to faith, I think, probably means something like the gospel shows us that being right with God comes about from faith and is given to the one who has faith. So it is by virtue of the fact that I have faith that I enter into life, and it is the one who has faith that is the recipient of that life. That's what I would understand him to be saying. Basically, my contention is that Paul and Habakkuk are saying the same thing, basically, in their two statements. The one who is right with God will not perish, and it is his faith that brings this about. Now, an interesting question that we might ask, if Habakkuk already said this, then is the gospel anything new and different? Is the gospel just a restatement of what Habakkuk said and other things said in the Old Testament? Well, I think that's sort of yes and no. The principle is exactly the same. The Old Testament made it clear that those with whom God is pleased are those who respond to him in faith, who hear his promises and believe them. But in the gospel, we now have the explicit declaration of how God is making it possible to justify ungodly people. It's the story of the sacrifice of his life that Jesus offered on the cross. In the Old Testament, God hinted at what he was going to do. In the New Testament, he has done it, and he is proclaiming explicitly what he did and why he did it. If it was a big deal for the Jews not to believe God when he said the Babylonians were coming through Habakkuk, it is a huge deal for us to blow off the message of how God is saving us eternally. Let me turn to the second part of our passage, starting with verse 18. And as I see it, let me sort of set up what I think is happening here as Paul starts to talk about the wrath of God. Paul is not just speaking in general terms about mankind's situation. I think he has something in mind when he goes into this section, because Romans is a letter that is designed to deal with the objections that have been raised by the Pharisees in particular to the gospel, as I understand it. They are saying, you can't really take seriously the Old Testament and be a Christian because this just doesn't work. Now, a key part of their perspective, as I would understand it, was this. The pagan Gentile was condemned because of his ignorance of the law. Why is it that Pharisee that I am, that God likes me and he doesn't like those pagans? Because they don't know the law. The law is there so it tells us the rules that if you keep them, God is happy. I know the rules, so I can keep them and God is happy with me. They don't know the rules, so God can't be happy with them. I think part of a key part of what Paul is trying to do in the first several chapters is to address this issue. Look, mankind's situation is not a problem of ignorance. In chapter 1, what he wants to say is, even the pagan out there worshiping idols has a true knowledge of God that he has put aside. And then when we come into chapter 2, he turns it around and says, and you, Jews who know the law, have no advantage by the fact that you know the law. And if we were looking at chapter 2, I could explain what I think is going on there. But I think that's what he's doing in this section. Now, I see 5 points made by Paul in this section that I think are relevant to our topic. So I want to just quickly bring those points out, and then I have some comments to make on the significance of them at the end. But let me just briefly highlight what I think the 5 points that I think are significant to our topic here. Point number one, first of all, Paul tells us some things about what mankind knows about God. It is not merely that God knows, that we know that God exists. We know something of the nature of God. His eternal power and divinity are clear enough that pagans are morally guilty for worshiping inferior idols. They are not congratulated for being theists. Hey, good job, you believe that there's a God out there somewhere. No, they are condemned for believing in the wrong gods. So it's not just that there is divinity in the world that we can see from creation. Paul is saying that we can actually see something of the nature of God and are culpable for rejecting that God for something with a different nature. My second point, creation is testifying. Paul emphasizes that the attributes of God are invisible. I mean, I can't see God. How do I know anything about God? And yet, we can know them because God has revealed himself in creation. The invisible God has made himself known in what he made. God has told us about himself, and so we cannot plead ignorance as an excuse because he has testified. My third point would concern the morality of knowledge. And what I mean to that is Romans 1 is making it clear that there is a moral dimension to knowledge. We ought to believe what is true and respond appropriately to that truth. And in this context, we ought to believe that God is our powerful and good creator and be grateful. The refusal of such knowledge is itself worthy of condemnation. And Paul's saying, we are under the wrath of God for choosing to believe the wrong thing. Okay? My fourth point would be that there is a willful dimension to knowledge. That is, our will plays a role in what we know. If we choose, we can refuse to accept a picture that we ought to accept because it's true and it deserves our belief because it is compellingly true, and yet we don't want to know it, and so we push it aside. That's the picture that Paul paints here of the suppression of the knowledge of God. We know it, but we don't want to know it, so we stop knowing it. You can say, in a sense, the very worst thing that can happen to a mind has happened to ours. We have become deliberately stupid. We have chosen to be in the wrong. I think it's very important to understand that dimension to knowledge. You can't understand the process of how we come to know things without realizing the role that our will plays in that knowledge. And then the final point that I see that I think is worth highlighting here is this idea that God gave them over. Romans 1 tells us that due to our rebellious refusal to know God, God has given mankind over to the fruits of our deliberate stupidity. We have cut ourselves off from the knowledge of God, and we're stewing in our ignorance. And God is leaving us to stew. That's the way I picture it. It's just, if you choose to be ignorant about the most fundamental thing in life, then everything's going to go wrong, and that's exactly what's happening. So although mankind has the intellectual ability to know the truth, we do not have the moral ability to welcome the truth, and so we become ever more stupid, which is a pretty profoundly depressing thing, but that's what Paul is saying is our situation. So, sum up these points. God has testified to his existence and his nature. We are capable of interpreting the testimony of God as it is revealed in creation. We have a moral obligation to believe this testimony. Our wills have instead led us to refuse the knowledge of God, and God has abandoned us to the consequences of our corrupt minds. That's a mouthful if you're talking about the state of human knowledge. Now, I have some comments to make, and really, I'm a little bit nervous about making these comments because this all deserves a lot more explanation than I can give. But I have to say some things if I'm going to say anything. So I apologize if it just seems like too much or you don't know what I'm saying. But I have to start out, before I make these comments, there's a picture I want to paint, because we're talking about reason here, what we believe and how we think and come to think about things. And I need to say something about how I think about our reasoning process. Okay, so how do we humans rationally decide whether idea X is true or false? Am I going to accept this idea X as being true or not? This is my picture. Very briefly, I apologize for that, but here's the deal. From my perspective, we start with a worldview, a picture of how the world is. Some of this picture we are born with, some of it we get from our parents and our community, and some of it we construct for ourselves as we're going along. Our worldview is made up of all kinds of things, the way I'm picturing it. It is our beliefs, our desires, our values, our emotions and speculations, the whole framework with which I respond to the world. I have this set of ideas and convictions and desires that have come together in me, and this is the tool that I have to understand the world. Then in the next step, when I'm confronted with some idea, X, I evaluate it in a fairly natural and easy way. It comes into my worldview, and if it fits there without strain and tension, I buy it. And if it somehow is at odds with this picture that I have, this tool that I have to understand the world, if somehow there's a tension and it doesn't fit, then I say, well, I just don't buy it. Most of the time, I don't go through some deductive process. Let me start with an assumption and prove that this is true or not true. I just ask myself, does it fit the way I see things or not? And if it doesn't, of course I don't believe it. I'm not going to believe something if it doesn't fit the picture of the world that I have. Now, this is a good thing, I want to say. This is the way we were made. This process is not an irrational one. It is the way we have been made to know things. Now, you know, a silly example. I've known my wife for many years. I have built up a picture of her character and personality and abilities and flaws and so on. So I hear someone say, I don't trust that woman. I think she's a big liar. Well, do I sit down and say, oh, now there's a proposition that's unsettling. Let me sit down and construct a deductive proof to prove whether or not my wife is a big liar. No, I take it in, and the picture that I have of her, everything that I know about her, says that person isn't getting it right. I don't even have to really think about it very hard. It just doesn't fit. So I don't believe it. And it's not wrong of me. I'm not being stubborn. You know, that person said your wife's a liar. You need to take that seriously. No, I don't. It doesn't fit anything I know. So I don't have to take that seriously. But you can see what the problem would be if my picture of reality is warped, if the worldview I have is not right, then things may fit easily into my worldview that are in fact not true. And I may reject things as false that are in fact true because they don't fit nicely into my picture of things. Okay, so are we stuck at that spot? I mean, that sounds like once you got a worldview, I mean, if you got the wrong one, good luck, because you're just going to see things wrong. Well, no, because of many of you will recognize how shamelessly I am borrowing this language from other better thinkers than myself. We have the phenomenon of the paradigm shift. And the idea being is that I have a worldview, but it may be that more and more things come along that show me the tensions in my worldview that I can't make this work. More and more stuff is coming along that I can't fit into the picture of the world that I have now. And so when the tension becomes unbearable, I find myself considering this different way of looking at things. And sooner or later, if the tension becomes unbearable, I make the shift. I move into this new picture of the world, and all of a sudden I say, you know, now it works. I got room. Those things that I couldn't deal with before, I can deal with them now. And again, I would say this is a rational process. It is, you know, as Polanyi would describe it, a tacit process mostly. I may somewhere along the line sit down and do some logical analysis and that kind of stuff, but a lot of it is just, look, the way I used to look at things doesn't work anymore, and the way I'm looking at things now works better. You might be thinking, oh, he believes in a pragmatic view of truth or something like that. No, we could talk about that if you want. Okay, but anyway, now why did I say all that stuff? Well, because I think it sort of helps me to make the comments that I want to make from Romans 1. First of all, it is very common for Christians to argue from Romans 1 that mankind has an innate knowledge of God. That is, we're born knowing that God exists in the same way that we're born knowing that we exist. I mean, I just know that I exist, and I know that God exists in this view. Well, the problem is, from my perspective, that's not what the passage says. The passage says that creation testifies to God's existence, and then we reject that testimony. Why is that an important issue? Well, let me just really briefly say, if the knowledge of God is innate, then I don't really have to defend it. I don't really have to rationally prove that it's so. I mean, this is what some Christian thinkers are trying to argue. You just get into trouble if you try to prove, like, you exist. I mean, from my perspective, in my ignorance, but when I look at the history of Western philosophy, a lot of where we went wrong is people saying, well, hey, I can't prove I exist. Hey, I can't prove cause and effect happens. And then we're in big trouble. And the answer to that, of course, is no, we're not. Who said you had to prove that stuff? Okay, well, so if the knowledge of God is like that, then the answer would be, I don't have to prove that either. That's just obvious. And let's move on to something more interesting. Well, I don't think that's quite what Paul is getting at here. What he's saying is that creation is like this book that God has written that I can read, and there is a testimony in it to God. But that means then there is something true about my mind, but not that I have an innate knowledge of God, but I have an innate ability to read the book. My mind is such that I can read the book of creation and come to know God. And I think that's what Paul's getting at. Now, if you're interested in this topic, Jack wrote his doctoral dissertation on this topic, arguing that the knowledge of God is not a basic belief in philosophical terms. And it's really good, and if you're interested, you should read it, and because he knows a lot more about it than I do. But it seems to me that Paul has got Jack's back here on this question. I mean, this is what he's saying. So what are you going to do? Okay, so my second comment. How is this process rational then? I mean, we're talking about that I'm using my mind to come to know that there is a God. I would answer this, well, let me say this. Darren and I were talking, and he was saying some really good things. It seems to us now that if we think of this argument as being, well, you look at the stars and the universe and the order that's there, and you say, where could that come from? I have no other explanation than God. Well, in our culture, we've been given an explanation, you know, the Big Bang and evolution and survival of the fittest and all of that kind of stuff. So maybe is it the case that the universe, the creation doesn't testify to us so well anymore because we have a way of explaining that stuff? Well, that's not how I picture the scenario. I come back to my picture of how we decide whether things are true or not. First of all, it's got to be true that Paul is not arguing that every single human being sits down and goes through this logical process of proving whether or not God exists. You know, it's not that the pagan, you know, out in the jungle somewhere is saying, I've been thinking about the ontological proof for God's existence. And, you know, in order to conceive of a perfect being, existence is innate in the conception of perfection. And, you know, I mean, no. This is not what's happening. And yet, Paul is saying that creation testifies, that we know that God is there. So right now, how I would explain that to myself is, as I come into a knowledge of myself and my world, everything that I know about myself and about the world that I live in provides a framework in which the existence of God is the only reasonable thing to conclude. Why am I a moral being? Why is the world ordered? Why does my mind work? Why am I different than the animals? Why do I have a longing for meaning? Why do I have a longing for things that I can't find fulfilled in this life? And all of that. I mean, we could go on and on. It seems to me that all of that stuff together, when the idea of the God of the Bible comes into the midst of that, not only does it all support that, but in fact, it in turn kind of provides the keystone that then makes everything else work really well. So that's why we would come to believe that God is there. Because if we were not morally corrupt, it would just make so much sense. It would just make everything so clear. Sooner or later, we would find our way to that because that's the way it's got to be. When I talk about reason entering into this process, again, I want that full-blown picture of reason that includes Polanyi's idea of tacit understanding and, you know, that idea that I have a rich mental history with which to understand the world. I don't mean sitting down and coming up with proofs like Euclid proving the Pythagorean theorem or something like that. My third topic, my comment, is for our topic this week, Romans 1 gives us an important picture of how the will corrupts our knowledge. When the pagan described in Romans 1 rejects the knowledge of God, he builds a new picture of the world. He doesn't want God to be God, but after God is excluded from the picture, he is perfectly happy to believe in an idol. I mean, it's not necessarily that we all become atheists. The issue is not whether or not there is a God. The issue became, what sort of a God am I going to believe in? Now, the idol truly makes sense, and the truths found in the Bible truly make no sense because of the worldview that has been constructed. Once you take the God that has shown himself in creation out of the picture, I come up with a new worldview, and yeah, hey, the stuff I see in the Bible, that doesn't make sense anymore. The unbeliever doesn't go around muttering, "There is no God," all day long. It is just that because he has refused to know God, now he has a worldview that God can't fit into. I mean, the unbeliever hears Christian theology described, and it genuinely seems stupid to him because he has a picture of the world that has no room for those things to be true or relevant. So, and I just think it's very important for us to understand how the will plays a role in that, that you're never going to get out of it until you are willing to see things that you were unwilling to see before. And so I think that's important to remember as we think about the so-called objectivity of the scientist. Okay, and then my last comment, sorry I'm going long here, I want to talk about the God of the gaps. Has that phrase come up in our discussions yet? Okay, well, many critics ridicule those who believe in any sort of creationism at all, including intelligent design and all that kind of stuff, for having a naive belief in the God of the gaps. And the idea is, look, if I look at something in the world and I can't explain it, then I say, oh, God must have done it. So we look back and say, it used to be that people couldn't explain where the rain came from. So we say, oh, the gods are sending the rain. But when we looked a little closer, we started to understand about, you know, the cycle of evaporation and how much moisture the atmosphere could hold at various temperatures and pressures, and, you know, and we can now explain where the rain comes from. Well, those who argue for intelligent design, for example, or any sort of creationism, are seen in that same way. You're just like those guys who thought, ooh, I don't know where the rain comes from. It must be God. You know, if you just wait, we'll come in with a rational explanation for where all of this stuff comes from, and we don't need to come in and say, oh, we can't explain it. It must be God. To me, probably one of the most important implications of Romans 1 for our discussion, then, is Paul's assertion that at a certain point, God is the rational explanation for what I see. I mean, Paul is saying, look, if creation testifies to the creator behind it, then that means ultimately some aspects of creation cannot be explained apart from God. The creation can't testify to God if every single aspect of creation can be explained in terms of its own natural existence. There is no testimony in creation if every single aspect of creation is explainable in naturalistic terms, including my nature, my human nature, my moral nature, and all this. If there is a rationalistic, natural explanation for it all, then Paul's wrong. He's just wrong. Creation does not testify to God. So Paul is implying here that there is a true gap. We can only go so far in explaining the world in terms of natural processes, at which point the only reasonable explanation for what we see is the Creator himself. Now, it's possible that someone like Behe is wrong about a particular cell that he's looking at. We might be able to find an explanation that says, oh, you know, there is actually a step-by-step process that could explain how this cell came to be. I'm not saying that Paul in Romans 1 is proving that Behe is right about every argument he makes about intelligent design, but it is an unbiblical argument to say we don't believe in the God of the gaps. If we take the Bible seriously, ultimately we do believe in the God of the gaps. That is, there comes a point at which it is right and appropriate to appeal to God as the Creator for the only possible explanation for what it is I see in the world. So that seems to me to be a real important implication of what Paul said. And now I'm done. Thanks.
Ron, I wanted to ask you, I think the answer was in your first talk, but I wanted to clarify. You had said that one option is that we choose to believe the wrong thing. Is that the same thing as believing the right thing but choosing to do the wrong thing?
I guess it would depend on... I could imagine it being the same thing, but my initial response is to say no, because in essence, I think all of us are as believers are in the situation where we believe the right thing, but we will do things that are not in keeping with what we believe, and that are against the thing that we believe. And so at least what I want to say is that as a believer, I think that is a very real phenomenon, and it's difficult to describe exactly the dynamic that goes into that. But how I have come to understand it is we need to make a distinction between this thing that has happened to my willingness to repent, to see that I am a sinner, to admit that God is there, all of those kinds of things. What hasn't changed is I still have this thing in me that draws me toward selfishness, self-centeredness, even though I acknowledge that God has the right to tell me what to do. Sometimes I just take off and I don't want to hear it and do something else, you know. That, in fact, I think the Christian life is the battle between the sanctification that is happening in my heart, if we could just localize it. Jack uses this language, and I like it. I mean, you know, to say that my heart is... I'm becoming the sort of person that if, for example, I do something like that, I come back to God and say, I shouldn't have done that. That I was in the wrong. Yeah. You know, I got to talking to that person and I got in an argument and I go back and I apologize to them and say, you know, I just got out of hand. I shouldn't have done that. Whereas before, I wouldn't have admitted that that was the case because I had to hold on to this idea that I'm in the right and you know, I'm the center of the universe and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's easy for us to have a tension between the particular responses that we have in the midst of life and the fundamental commitment that we have, because we have these two things at war in us. Now, would it be possible? I think there's another scenario we could propose where I have a belief that is only just on the surface. I say I believe it, but in fact it has very little to do with what I actually believe. And so the tension between what I say I believe and what I do is at a more fundamental level. So both of those things are possible. But we're not hypocrites as Christians. The fact that I'm a sinner does not prove I'm not a believer.
I want to make sure I got what you said right. You said believing that God is real is reasonable. But in order to see this, we must throw away our irrationality in how we see God. Was that correct?
Yeah, what I'm saying is the hostility that I have to those truths is itself irrational. I mean, it is against reason. Reason would pull me toward belief in God, but I won't go there. I don't want it to be true. So even as I'm telling myself I'm being very objective and rational and in my rejection of any belief in God, in fact, I'm not, I would argue. I mean, the Bible has to be telling us that in essence, I am taking knowledge that I could have had. It's good knowledge, something that I could count on, but I'm putting it aside. And that's irrational. I mean, that's refusing to use my mind the way God made it to work, so.